Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 245 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'd like to first introduce David Vanderhoof, returning from the What Just Flew By blog. Hi, David.
Hey, Max. Sorry about missing last week, but, you know, it's spring finally here in Pennsylvania, so therefore allergies and sinus infections occur. But glad to be back.
Glad to have you back. You know, our listeners noticed we got a little bit of listener mail that said, where is David? When's he coming back? So they noticed. You ought to feel good about that, right?
Well, yeah, either that or they're just wondering why the podcast quality went up without me around.
No, I don't think so. Oh, also co-hosting, of course, is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog.
Hey, hi, guys, and good evening, everybody. And David, don't feel bad. At least they mentioned you by name. If I wasn't here, they'd say, where's the old guy? And the old guy this weekend was floating around Chicago. I finally learned what it's like to be in heavy rain where you cannot see more than 30 feet in front of you, because that's about all I could see the other morning when it was raining so hard. And we got 3 inches of rain in an hour.
Wow.
And that's a lot of water.
We're glad you survived, more or less, although I guess you've got some wet carpeting that you're offering for sale cheap.
I'm happy to mail it to people. I'll cover the UPS. You just have to be ready when you open the box. It's a little stinky, but other than that, that's probably TMI.
But you think at your age you would have known better and you would have built an ark.
Well, yeah, and I have one of the animals already.
That's right, Simba.
And he didn't like it. The cats definitely did not like it. They are not water creatures at all.
All right. Well, enough about the weather. Let's talk about David. In fact, instead of a guest this episode, this is kind of the David Vanderhoof story, or the David Vanderhoof show. Let's call it that. And David, you were just recently at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum for an event.
We're very fortunate that we actually have a very good relationship with the National Air and Space Museum. I was invited to be one of 10 social media participants of their newest exhibit, Time and Navigation. Normally, they do a couple days before the opening to everyone, they open the museum up to the press. This time, they included since 10 social media people to cover it from a social media standpoint. And fortunate enough, I was given the privilege of being there, getting down at 8 o'clock in the morning on a Wednesday after my little 3-hour drive or 2-hour drive and 1-hour train ride, and got to be there before the museum opened to the general public and had breakfast with the social media staff. And then we had the press conference, and then we were given a tour of the new exhibit by the 4 curators of the exhibit.
Oh, that's great. And you had your recorder with you, so you made some good recordings and some interviews, and we've got those coming up to listen to. So that's going to be our main topic for this episode. And, of course, we've also got our contributors, Grant and Steve from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast with their Australia Desk report. Peter comes in with another great Across the Pond segment. Peter covers European aviation and surrounding areas for us. And we've also got another listener story that we'd like to play for you. We've been running one of those each week where we have a listener send in a recording telling us about their first flight or how they got interested in aviation, that sort of thing. And we'll finish up with a little bit of the listener mail that we've received in the past week. First, though, let's get started with some aviation news. Is everyone ready?
Well, actually, I'm not ready.
You're not?
Because I have a question that's just
okay.
Bugging me. So David calls in sick last week,
yep,
and he gets his own segment this week, and I've got to listen to Steve and Grant on their segment, and Peter on his segment, and then some listener, I don't even know who the listener is, no offense, I mean, we'll listen to your story, but I don't get a story. Why is that, Max?
Well, okay. Well, I'll tell you what. We'll throw you a bone, a small bone, in that in the news segment, we'll make a little bit of it about you. How's that?
Oh, okay, gosh, that's pretty nice.
Okay.
You guys.
Are we ready to get started now? Our first story comes from Fox News. FAA approves resumption of Boeing's 787 Dreamliner flights. Well, it's finally happened. We've talked about this for, well, 3 months now, actually. And the FAA has just informed the U.S. Congress that after being grounded for those 3 months, the Boeing 787 Dreamliners could be flying again as early as within a week. So even though we don't know the root cause for the thermal meltdown of the lithium-ion batteries, the FAA has approved Boeing's solution. And according to the Fox News story, Boeing is ready for this. They have reportedly stationed some 300 people around the world to support airlines with the work, which takes 5 days for each Dreamliner. So it's not an insignificant task to install the new equipment. As we've talked before in the past, we kind of know what the fix is. It's additional insulation around each of the battery's 8 cells to help prevent short circuits or fire even in one of the cells from spreading to the others. And they've done some work with venting the smoke and gas from inside the battery to outside of the airplane. And then finally, at least in terms of the hardware, they've got a strengthened box that's going to hold the battery. And the idea is that it would ensure that if there was a fire, it wouldn't escape into the rest of the plane, that it would be contained. So this is, this is great news for Boeing to finally get the approval to go ahead.
Maybe it's me, but I don't know that I'm really happy with the fact that they have a fix, but no root cause. I know in my real world work environment, it drives me absolutely nuts when people put in fixes, but they never really address what's causing it in the first place.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm being paranoid, maybe, but I think Boeing really needs to maybe come up with a long-term solution and not just a fix.
You know, I don't have any information, but I suspect that they're going to keep more than a few engineers working on this. I mean, we have to eventually understand, like you say, David, what's actually going on inside that battery that's causing this difficulty, because it kind of casts a pall over lithium ion batteries, not just in Boeing aircraft, but elsewhere. Yeah,
and I have to agree with David on this one. I mean, when I talked to one of the Chicago Tribune reporters the other day when the announcement was made, they said, well, so what do you think? And I said, well, I said pretty much the same thing. It's great for Boeing. I'm sure their stockholders will be happy and all the employees will be happy and the guys in the head shed will be happy. But as a pilot, I got to tell you, I'm a little uncomfortable with flying an airplane that has a severe problem. And we still don't know what caused it. I'm assuming it wasn't something as simple as it was a bad battery run or something like that, because there have been other issues with lithium ions. But yeah, it's nice to know that they say it's protected so it can't catch fire. But God, I gotta tell you, it's just me. It just makes me really uncomfortable to know that we still could have the same situation occur, and because we don't really know what caused it in the first place. And then I guess, well, you know, maybe the boxes will hold. Well, I'm assuming the boxes will hold. I doubt FAA would have stuck its neck out on this one if they weren't really, really sure. But it just bothers me.
I think it'll be interesting to see how this is managed, you know, how the public relations aspect of this is managed. I mean, if at all. I mean, do you think they'll just implement the fixes, put the planes back up in the air, and nobody's going to say anything? Or do you think we're going to see some?
Yeah, that's exactly what I think they're going to do. I think the less publicity about this, the better. And at least if I were Boeing, That would be what I would be thinking. I don't think you're ever going to convince the average traveler about the technology. I think it's probably way too complicated to really explain and to say, oh, by the way, but we really don't know why the problem occurred, but we're sure we've got a way to put the fire out in case it starts. I don't know.
It's a tough one.
I think that's going to be a tough message to get across to the average Joe.
Would the average Joe actually pay attention?
That's a good question.
Oh, no, I don't think they do either. And that's why I'm saying I think that Boeing will go the route of just saying, airplane's fine, let's get them back in service. Oh, okay.
I did see an interesting article in the Wall Street Journal that's titled How Boeing Rescued the 787. And they made some interesting points. One is a quote from this article that says Boeing is expected to take somewhat of a backseat role in marketing the 787 to passengers, according to industry officials familiar with the matter. Boeing's primary role is expected to be helping carriers devise their own public relations tactics to reintroduce the cutting-edge jet to the public. I guess I could also see the carriers, maybe if they're the mouthpiece on the television commercial, I can see them wanting to get something from Boeing to help fund that.
But, you know, I go back to what David just said. I think they're not going to want to keep sparking the conversation unless people ask. And I'll bet you a lot of people are just not going to ask. I think people that are engineering minded may, or perhaps people that travel in the industry, but you know, some accountant that's traveling from New York to Houston on an airplane, I don't know that he knows or that he cares. If the airline says it's fine, don't worry about it, you go, okay.
And once they start flying, you'll know, because if you start seeing people want to change their flight because it has their ticket has 787 on it, like L-1011s and DC-10s in the early 80s, then there's going to be some discussion about rebranding it. But up until that occurs, I think it's going to be, well, it's fixed, let's go.
You know, I was thinking about what the cost to Boeing is of all this, and I'm sure someone at Boeing, well, obviously has a dollar figure that's been calculated, but and we really can't do that, or we're not really equipped to estimate that, but just in terms of sort of categories of cost to Boeing, I started to make a list, and the more I thought about it, the longer the list got. But you know, they've had delayed deliveries, so there's you know, aircraft that have been manufactured but sitting on the ground undelivered. There's the likelihood of penalties or warranty claims to the airlines. Who knows what those look like. Boeing has said that they devoted 200,000 hours of engineering, design, analysis, and testing. That's a lot of labor. Those costs add up pretty quickly. You guys have mentioned sort of the loss of goodwill, both to the passengers, to airlines, and I don't know, Rob, what do you think? Maybe even to the regulatory agencies. I mean, do you think in the future, you know, for the next airplane or the next variant of this airplane that, you know, the FAA and others are going to look at Boeing a little bit differently than they did in the past as a result of this? Or do you think it'll be just business as usual?
No, I think you're absolutely right. They will look at them differently, hence the 200,000 man hours of engineering time. I think Boeing certainly stuck its neck out, but so did the FAA on this one, because neither one of them can afford to be wrong. And who knows? We may just go along and a year from now, 2 years from now, we'll be saying, wow, I guess they really did figure out what the issue is. Well, I'm sorry. We know that I'm assuming they're still looking for the issue. That's the part of the story that I haven't heard anybody talk about. I've just heard about the fix. But I bet you a year or two from now, everything will be fine, and everyone will say, well, see, it was no big deal, and life goes on. But God help them if there's anything even remotely close to an incident that is lithium-ion battery related in that airplane. That airplane, it'll be incredible if it ever flies again. It's going to be a mess. So I don't wish Boeing ill. I don't at all. And I'm just saying, but the risk is just unbelievable. And hence, I think that's why it's taken 3 months for Boeing to convince FAA. And I'm sure that when they walked out of the administrator's office, he probably looked at his people and said, you know, you guys better be right. Because let's face it, the FAA is in way over its head. Boeing knows way more about all this technology than anybody on the FAA staff does, I'm sure.
But, Rob, if you talk about short-term memory, do you remember how much we used to talk about the fact that it never flew, it never flew, it never flew, it never flew? Oh, it's supposed to fly next month. It'll be next month. It's quick. How quick we forgot it once it was up in the air.
That's true. That's true.
Forgot what?
All the designs.
That was a little short-term memory. That was okay. Anyway, no, that's an interesting point. You know, I don't think anybody has brought that up. How many delays that airplane took for one reason or another. But I don't think we ever heard any of them related to this technology, though. I don't think there was ever a story about the lithium ions other than the fact that they were in there that I can remember. Mm-hmm. Do you?
No.
Well, it's interesting. Like I said, I hope it goes well.
Sure,
but
yeah.
The big question everybody says, would you fly on a 787? And David and I were talking on Twitter the other day because I couldn't find anything about them having reauthorized the ETOPS, which allows them to fly quite a way out over the water. And apparently they did put it back together. But, wow, 3 or 4 or 5 hours away from a base in that airplane? Not in the first year. Yeah, I think I'll let someone else be the guinea pig for this.
You know, one last thought for me is that if I was an airline, looking at this, regardless of whether or not I had purchased 787s, next time I was buying fairly new in its life cycle airplane, I'd want to make sure I negotiated some really good warranties into that thing so that if something like this ever did happen again, that I'd be covered. I mean, I don't know what the airlines had negotiated. I don't know if they'd all had great warranties, so they're all, going to be made whole by Boeing, or if there's some risk sharing, or who knows? I don't know what the agreements are like, but, man, I just wonder if going forward, those that didn't have real great warranties built into their contracts with Boeing are going to really want to negotiate those. And not just with Boeing, but with for an A350 or anything else that's new coming down the line. How much risk do you want to take on if you're an airline?
Well, that's an interesting point, because look at how many of the Neos that Airbus sold. Well, there were well over 1,000 orders, I think, already, aren't they?
Oh, it's just tons and tons of orders. And for the 737 MAX also.
That's a fairly proven airframe. But the 350, I don't know. I mean, think about the days you bought a car and somebody said, you don't want to buy the first year of a brand new model. It's never been out there. Yeah, you never know what you're going to catch up with. And we never thought like that about airplanes. I don't know. Maybe they're becoming so complicated, people are going to start thinking like that.
Well, it's like buying version 1.0 of some great new software, right? You really want to wait till that 1.1 version comes out, unless you like being on the cutting edge. But I think that gets taken into account financially, too. That's one reason why launch customers tend to enjoy really significant discounts because of those kind of risks. But the bottom line, I guess, is that it looks like the Dreamliners are going to get back up into the sky relatively quickly. And I guess we all kind of conclude the same thing, that we'd be more comfortable if we knew exactly what was going on with those batteries. But I don't know. Personally, I'm pretty confident that they've got a decent containment system so that if we do get some thermal runaway, it's not going to result in a really tragic kind of an accident. But hopefully it'll play out that way.
Okay, I agree with that.
All right, so that's enough about that. hopefully we won't have any other 787 Dreamliner stories for quite a while, so we can spare our listeners that conversation.
Oh, ye of so little faith.
I know. Who knows?
It's going to be another tanker.
Oh, gosh. I hope not. All right. Well, let's see. Next story. This comes from the Jerusalem Post. And actually, this link came in from a listener we have in Israel, Noam. I appreciate him sending us the link to this article. It's titled, Open Skies Strike Threatens to Stop Air Traffic. So Noam, in his email to us, says in Israel at the moment, there are moves to pass an open skies agreement, allowing more competitors to enter the aviation market in Israel. The three Israeli airlines are protesting this. As a result, no flights are coming in or out of Israel. And there's also an NPR article in this on this topic, Israel's three airlines strike over EU proposal, which adds some to the to this topic. And the NPR says the Open Skies Agreement with the European Union would reduce restrictions on European carriers for using Israeli airspace, increasing competition. It would expand the number of flights between Israel and European countries and allow Israel to become a layover hub. Now it's a final stop. So this is something that would happen over a period of 5 years, according to the Jerusalem Post article. And the politicians see this as a good thing, as a positive thing, bringing more tourists to Israel, making it more attractive, increasing competition, perhaps lowering airfare costs. But the Israeli airlines the employees are not so excited about this idea, and they see it as a threat to their position. What do you guys think? This is kind of a story that we see played over in different countries and different industries where the competition starts to come in, or the possibility of it, and the sort of the status quo gets nervous about what the result might be.
Personally, I'm kind of surprised that the Israeli politicians are taking this route from a security standpoint. Israel as a layover hub with their security would be really interesting for a lot of people. And they usually want to limit the volume coming in and out of the country. I'm kind of, from a security standpoint and the fact that my background is Arab-Israeli conflicts, I'm kind of surprised that they want to go this route. Normally, Israel sides on the side of security, and they're very tight with their own airline. So having other European nations come in is sort of surprising.
Sure, the Israeli security is kind of legendary, not just in the aviation industry, but especially.
Yeah, kind of legendary. Yeah. I hate to keep saying the same thing over again, but I agree with David. David, we got to work on this. No one's going to want to listen to this show if I keep agreeing with you.
They listened to the show for my age jokes about you.
Well, that too. I mean, that's what we used to have the kid. What was his name? Remember the kid that used to work here? The one that we finally tied up and left by the road, hoping someone would pick him up. And eventually they did and dragged him to Colorado. I forgot his name, but seriously. Yeah, I just think this is an unusual move too. I mean, let's face it. Any airline, bunch of airline employees are always worried about competition because they're worried about jobs. But look at Australia. Look at that Southeast Asia region where how many stories have Steve and Grant come up with over the years about the carriers down there and the fun they've had with one trying to undercut the other and just, you know, crazy, crazy stories. And they've had quite a few in Europe as well. So it's not exactly as if this is a given that more airlines coming in. It's simply going to bring more tourists. It's probably going to be a little more chaos too. And I don't know. I'm kind of surprised on this myself.
And Israel is basically as a hub or a hub and spoke. It's really not that far from Etihad's home base, which is rapidly becoming the hub of all airlines through Asia and stuff. And I mean, Israel is going to be able to compete against that. I guess it makes it sound good, but economically, who's going to go? Who? I mean, LAL is suddenly going to become the start buying A380s and fly around the world. I don't see that happening.
The Jerusalem Post also mentioned an interesting aspect to the security angle that's being raised by the airlines, and they're saying that, you know, as we've mentioned, the security is superb, but that costs a lot. That comes at a certain price, and of course that's baked into the price of the tickets. If you bring in other airlines that are competing that don't have that sort of high fixed security cost, they'll be able to undersell the Israeli airlines, admittedly without the same level perhaps of security, but that, you know, the LALs and the others won't be able to compete on strictly on price with the competition. And they see that as being sort of unfair, that you know, the playing field isn't level.
Yeah, but I didn't think the security in going in and out of Ben Gurion would be up for discussion. I mean, I would think that the Israelis would want all the airlines to maintain the same sort of security, and then, you know, however you guys want to compete after that, go for it. But, you know, the security is what the security is. I don't see them changing any of their standards for any newcomer at all.
The cost of doing business there is so high. Who's going to want to jump into that ring and go, hey, yeah, we're going to suddenly fly to Israel and you can fly to Asia through Ben Gurion? Yeah, I don't see that happening, because once they land at Ben Gurion and the Israeli forces get them off the airplane, they have to go through security to get back on the airplane to leave, then no one's going to want to do that. They're going to want to fly a couple of hundred miles farther west, land at Etihad's home airport, and could then go on to Asia without the hassle. So,
well, we want to thank Noam for sending us that article and pushing us a little bit maybe to discuss something maybe a little bit out of our comfort zone.
He didn't tell us who he worked for, did he?
No, he did not. No, he did not.
I wonder if... Okay, fess up, Noma. Huh? We want to know who you work for.
But
yeah, let us know.
But let's encourage our listeners to, you know, if you see something that you might want to hear us talk about, you can always send the stories to us, and we'll do the best we can with what we got, which usually isn't much, but you know that by now.
Hey, speak for yourself.
And speaking of, you know, doing with what we've got, a third article here. This is titled, Sometimes Saying No is Just Plain Stupid. And this comes from Jetwine.com, written by our own Rob Mark. So this past Sunday, the sequestration-driven controller cuts started to take effect. So Uncle Rob, what does it all mean?
It means that for once I'm just really mad. I think that what's really irritating about this is that this is the other part of the sequestration cuts that people probably forgot about, because the FAA suddenly found money, even though they were broke, to put the contract tower issue on hold for 3 months, and yet this one took over. And of course, what's happening here in the States is that even essential FAA personnel are being furloughed 1 day or 2 days a month, essentially, for no means they're, you know, they're not going to work and they're not going to get paid. The issue has always been that air traffic controllers were considered essential personnel, kind of like cops. Cops or firemen. You just didn't get rid of them for any reason. And even during the days, well, remember we had Bob Poole on last month, and we were talking about privatization and all that stuff of the air traffic control system. And Bob and I have had long discussions about that. And it's, you know, one of the reasons that privatization has always had its legs shot out from under it is that everyone always said, oh, well, air traffic control is essentially a government function. And this is an essential government function. except now these people are not essential anymore. And what's going to happen, though, is that, well, actually, I have to be honest, we're not really sure what is going to happen. Everybody's predicting, but we've never faced this before. It was kind of like the control tower contract, control tower issue from last month, except this one's going to be worse, or at least that's my two cents on this. But if for any reason, now for those people that are not airline geeks, all the major hubs have a bank that leave in the morning, and the bank is just the first bunch of airplanes that depart a hub at maybe, oh, I don't know, 6-7 o'clock in the morning. And all the airlines do it, and they all go in different directions. And when those airplanes get to some other major city, they become the return flight out of that city to someplace else, and so on and so on and so on. Well, if you delay a chunk of those airplanes somewhere in the system, or let's say at 20 or 30 hubs, you're going to screw up the entire country.
It cascades, sort of, doesn't it?
Yeah, airplanes won't be where they need to be. Pilots won't be where they need to be. People are going to end up sitting around waiting for airplanes that possibly show up or possibly don't show up. Or when they do, they may be who knows how late. And I just think it's going to be nutty. But what I think is really the most irritating part of this whole thing is that FAA says that they have to do this because they don't have the money. And other people have said, well, come on, FAA, you've got a, I don't know, what is it, a $4 billion budget or something like that, I think, every year. And take some money from this thing, this pot, and put it over here, and let's keep these guys on duty. And they said, oh, you know, we can't do that. And that's kind of what my editorial on Jetwine was about, is you can't? My fanny, you can't.
Yeah, that's the way real business works.
Yeah, I mean, FAA
but
is
this
saying
isn't
no.
real business. This is the federal government.
That's
I know.
That's
it, right. It just doesn't work the same way. I mean, in my company, when times are tough and you know the belt has to be tightened, you look for opportunities. You look for waste. You look for how can you be more efficient. It's not always about reducing manpower or just taking something that you're doing and saying, okay, we're not going to do that anymore. It's typically more about saying, well, how can you do that, but in a way that doesn't cost as much money? But the, I don't know, the federal government never does it that way.
Yeah, but the other thing about it is, the other part about it is, I mean, we all, our outside jobs and our family lives, we have these things, they're called budgets. You know, my office, I have a budget. I make my budget every year, and I'm supposed to either go work and hit that budget or come under that budget. If I come under that budget, I'm, quote, successful. The FAA's got a budget. If they don't have enough money for air traffic controllers, which is, and if you don't have, excuse me, if you don't have anything in your budget to cover, enough money to cover necessities, which usually is the first thing you budget for, I don't understand. I mean, air traffic controllers are the single most important thing the FAA does. And
well, and I see, I think that's really where I was headed with that whole thing, too, is that FAA said no to the requests for adjustment of the budget because my buddy Ray LaHood at the DOT told them that that's what they're going to say. And because DOT tells FAA what to do. But of course, the chief of staff at the White House is most likely the one that told Mr. LaHood what to do. And I think what really irritates me the most about this, and you guys out there in listener land, please call me, email me, tell me if I'm wrong. Show me another U.S. government agency that seems to be taking it on the chin so publicly as the aviation industry is. And I'm sorry, I really believe that this has become such a political football that this is the White House's opportunity to tweak the noses of the Republicans. And I just think that we're all stuck in the middle. And I'm really not happy about that. Certainly from a White House that's a Democrat in there, which, okay, I'm sorry, I voted for the guy. But yeah, the point is that none of us should be going through this when we have people in Congress that should be sticking up for us. And I'm just in Illinois, the two that I know haven't done a thing about this so far. I can't even get answers out of them, and I'm not happy about it. And I think we're being way too nice to our congressman these days by just saying, well, if I send you an email, would you please give me the honor of a response? And I just think maybe we're kind of past that kind of stuff in this industry, and being nice just doesn't seem to be getting us anywhere.
Well, I mean, Rob, if you want me to name another industry, I believe the defense industry would be the number one group that's taking it on the nose. And
good point.
Defense and aviation sort of go hand in hand. Usually it's the same players, and it's just insane.
However, defense, think of defense. Now, do the folks that live out in Orange County or in Owensboro, Kentucky, or up in Schenectady, New York, are they going to feel the direct effects of budget cuts to the Defense Department? Short of, if we're invaded by, Wolverines or, I don't know, whatever. But what I'm saying is I don't think there's another industry that is so publicly tied as this one is. And I'm not saying the people that work for the large defense corporations aren't upset too. They are. But I don't think the public is going to feel as much of the defense cuts personally as they will about this.
At this point, this is one of those things where I would disagree, because all of the infrastructures around military bases that are closing or squadrons disappearing and people leaving the military to go into the public realm, there's nothing going to be there for them. And that's going to affect, when you close down a base, taxes, money, people leave the area, stores close. Look at what happened to the Space Coast now that Kennedy Space Center and the shuttle program's done. Anytime you kill a major infrastructure or something that the United States is really, really good at, aviation, defense, it's going to hurt the country overall. We're doing stupid things because this was supposed to be the nuclear mad mutual assured destruction. Neither the Republicans or the Democrats thought that this was going to be such a good idea. We were going to come up with a budget. Well, they let it happen. And unfortunately, it's us people who out in the real world who are getting hurt by it.
Yeah, but you know what I think the problem is, in your mutually assured destruction concept, is that I think people do believe, the average citizen does believe, the Defense Department, they probably do spend way too much money anyway. I mean, my God, look at the F-35 project. And so if you were trying to make a point to an average Joe, the ones that are going to ride on the 787, the story would, I think it would be easy for them to say, I could kind of see how that might happen. I'm not saying that it's right or that your point about the base closings is not, but I'm saying that when you come to an industry that they say they're not trying to kill, we're not trying to kill aviation, we're not trying to kill the airlines or business aviation, or we're not trying to do that, but you are. Oh, no, we're not. And I just think that's amazing, and I just think we've put up with it way too long, but that's just my two cents.
For our main topic, we have David's report from the National Air and Space Museum. Now, David, we've got a couple of things to listen to. Do you want to sort of tee this up?
A couple of things occurred. One was we had an introduction by the director of the National Air and Space Museum. And then I think the second thing we're going to listen to is the museum exhibit is divided into four sections. One is early navigation with sailing vessels and clocks. The next thing would be aviation navigation, which talks about from navigating from the Wright Flyers all the way up to navigating in an SR-71, which brings us to the next topic, which was navigation in space, you went from navigating in two dimensions to navigating in three dimensions to navigating in four dimensions for all intents and purposes, because you have to include time, space, up, down, left, right. The last part of the exhibit is navigation today, what it means to have GPS satellites and the fact that all of our phones are our connection to the world. You know, we just type in a place and suddenly your phone can give you directions. So, and how navigation has become not a specialized tool or a specialized trade, but an everyday item. I mean, who doesn't use GPS anymore? I guess what we should do is just roll tape.
All right. So the first recording we've got from David is the tour introduction.
Navigation, the untold story of getting from here to there, which is our newest gallery. And this is, our, of course, our press preview. I want to point something out. One of the things that as we upgrade our exhibits here in the museum, we're trying to automate to where possible and also to reduce staffing requirements and to have computer control where possible. And what we thought we were going to do this morning was to show you how our clock, which is right above the entrance, how it's atomically controlled clock, so it's extremely accurate. And the computer has it set to go off at 10 o'clock. So that's what automation does for you. Sometimes you're not. Now, we could have taken a pole and climbed up on a ladder and pushed a button, but we thought that might take away a little bit from all of our automation and computerization here. But today's preview marks a change in the way we conduct press activities also. In addition to the members of the broadcast and media print, we've invited a group of special social media followers, and thank all of you for coming this morning. The exhibition traces the development of complicated technologies and makes us think about a subject that we now take for granted. It's in a chronologically presented, while at the same time analyzes innovation in different modes of travel and environments. It explores possibilities for the future and asks challenging questions for the next generation of scientists and explorers to face. And we've heard in history, we've heard of comments being made, well, there's nothing left to invent. And there's a feeling today with GPS and the accuracy that we have and being able to determine our location, what else is there? There's a lot. And what we hope we do here is to inspire young people particularly to be interested in taking up the challenge and looking into the future and what can be done beyond this. The time and navigation came together as a result of many individuals and organizations who contributed time, talent, and expertise. The exhibition is unique in that it is a collaboration of two Smithsonian museums. And this is unique because very seldom do two museums put on an exhibit at the same time. This is actually our second exhibit with American history, and we're very pleased. They hold the clock collection for the Smithsonian, and we're delighted to be partnering on this this activity. The consortium, producing a gallery of this magnitude in time and navigation could not have happened without vision, commitment, and financial support. And it's important to point out at this, you've heard me say it at all of our events, we couldn't do anything in this museum without with sponsorship. And that we get a federal budget which pays the salaries of the federal employees, but nothing else is funded by, in this museum, is funded by federal money. So without sponsorship, we don't do things. And so we're deeply indebted to our sponsors for everything we do every day, but also specifically for this event. And it's interesting because it includes a spectrum of aerospace community and from government agencies to corporations. And I'd like to recognize them here this morning. The sponsors include Northrop Grumman Corporation, Excellus Incorporated, Honeywell, National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, U.S. Department of Transportation, Magellan GPS, National Coordination Office for Space-Based Positioning, Navigation, and Timing. How's that for a timing? And Rockwell Collins and Institute of Navigation. How about a round of applause for our sponsors? Thank you very much.
David, this is at the downtown Washington facility of the Air and Space Museum. Is that right?
Yeah, it's in the original building. On the upper floor, if you know the museum, it's the second floor. It's as you walk towards the Apollo lunar lander and the McDonald's end of the building. It's at the upper left-hand side. Now, the clock they talked about is basically a whole wall that when it goes off as planned, has, besides a clock movement, has an airplane that moves, a submarine that surfaces and unsurfaces, satellites that orbit around, chimes that go off. It's a pretty spectacular portion of the exhibit, and we'll have photographs of that on the main page.
And so you took the tour, and we have the recording of the tour, which covered the role of the clock. They talked about navigating at sea, navigating at the air, as you mentioned, David, navigating in space, and then satellite navigation. And we'll put all that in the show notes at airplanegeeks.com, so you can listen to the entire tour. But I think, David, what we're going to listen to next is Roger Connor talking about the aviation part of the gallery. Is that right?
Yes. Roger actually was a curator for the aviation section. So he will give us a lesson on navigation from the earliest airplanes up through World War II and Loran up to space navigation. So take it away. Well, folks, you've just listened to the tour. Now we're going to get into a little bit more detail. I'm here with Roger Connor, curator, and we're going to talk about the aviation portion of the gallery. Roger, thank you for being on Airplane Geeks.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me a little bit about the exhibit, but a little bit more detail.
So the exhibit is telling the story of navigation, but it's telling it from a particular perspective, and that is time. And a lot of people don't realize that time is essentially the most important part of knowing where you are. And we look at really three technologies through time. We look at the mechanical clock, we look at the quartz oscillator, the quartz clock, and the atomic clock, and how those three technologies have shaped the way that we navigate at sea, the way we navigate in the air, the way we navigate in space.
And, okay, we're standing in the aircraft version where we originally, the first part of the section is we talk about nautical navigation. Now let's talk about some of the things that are featured in this gallery with the aviation.
So the real problem with navigating in the air, especially just after World War I, when long-range flying was really starting to emerge as a viable option for both military and commercial use, the problem was how do we navigate? How do we navigate long distances over water especially? And the first techniques that were used, of course, were trying to adapt those same techniques that had worked so well at sea in the 19th century, so celestial navigation using a sextant and a chronometer, a watch. Unfortunately, when you try and use those same techniques in an aircraft where it's hard to see the horizon, where you have 100-mile-an-hour wind in your face in an open cockpit, your maps are flapping about, it's a big problem. It took those mariners 15 to 30 minutes to work out a celestial fix. If you try to do that in an aircraft with all these other distractions going on, you're going to have a real problem. So one of the real challenges of the 1920s and 30s was to bring those techniques that were used at sea down to a period of use, for instance, less than 2 minutes, that made them practical. Things also had to be made a lot more compact and easy to use in the cockpit. One thing that people don't realize is that sextants actually had to be made more aerodynamic. So if you had a traditional marine sextant, you tried to hold it out in the wind to take a sighting, it was going to be really difficult to use. So one of the cases that we have in the gallery, we actually show what a aerodynamic sextant looks like compared with one that was less aerodynamic. And so that's one of the things that's happening in the early 20s. We tell the story of some of the early Navy flying boats and how difficult it was for them to get their navigational techniques down. So there's the flight of the NC-4, first flight across the Atlantic in 1919. That was an episode that was fraught with navigational hazards and miscues. The one aircraft, the NC-4, made it successfully. The NC-1 and NC-3 did not due to navigational errors. The Navy attempted the first flight to Hawaii by air in 1925 with an aircraft called the PN-9. That also had an unfortunate episode. The crew survived, but the aircraft was lost at sea for 10 days, again, due to navigational errors. And so when Charles Lindbergh tries to fly the Atlantic in 1927, he has to only look back at these other flights and see how limited in capability a lot of these technologies are. So celestial navigation, it's pretty obvious it's not working all that well for these guys. Radio navigation, it's pretty clear it's not working very well. So when he has the option of how he's going to fly across the Atlantic, he goes with what he knows, which is essentially that seat of the pants dead reckoning that had served him so well as a male pilot. And so it was all about holding heading and time, trying to assess the winds. And he was very fortunate. A lot of people don't realize that Lindbergh, on the day of his Paris flight, had near-perfect weather. Now, if you read his memoirs or you've seen the Jimmy Stewart movie, you understand there's a lot of clouds and low-visibility situations they ran into. But the net wind drift for that flight was zero. So the weather patterns that were across the North Atlantic that day resulted in a net wind drift of zero. So when people hear that Lindbergh made landfall in Ireland within 3 miles of his intended course, it's usually regarded as a superhuman feat of navigation. In reality, it was a lot of luck. Lindbergh was really doing this by the seat of the pants, and a lot of people followed in his footsteps, particularly in 1927. One of the things that we show in this exhibit is that about 40% of the people that attempted Lindbergh's similar flights to Lindbergh perished around that time. And that's because the navigational technology wasn't quite there. So one of the things that we use to demonstrate this is we have this this gorgeous map that we use to demonstrate the long-distance flights of 1927 and how many of them ended in disaster. And we also go out of our way to put some human faces on these people, that a lot of whom lost their lives. And this is an untold story, I think, for the most part, that a lot of people see Lindbergh as kind of the end of...
The out of the blue.
Right.
It just happened.
It's the end of the immature phase of navigation. Well, that's not really true. And the real meat that we get into in this gallery is telling the story about what happens after Lindbergh flies to Paris. So one of the things that happens is early 1928, he's flying around Mexico, Latin America, the Caribbean, in the Spirit of St. Louis, and he actually gets lost on a couple of occasions. The worst case, he gets lost between Havana and Southwest Florida, winds up over the Bahamas over 300 miles off course due to problems with his compass. And that's when the light bulb really goes on for him. So he says, you know, I really need to find somebody that understands this navigation thing, because if we want long-distance commercial service, we have to have reliable navigation. We don't have that right now. How are we going to fix that?
And that navigator was Annie Mora?
No, so that
Miss Lindbergh was...
No. So that navigator was PVH Weems. So it was a naval officer who had been working kind of on his own without a lot of official support. And what he did is he took those problems of navigating at sea, the celestial navigation techniques that mariners have been using, and adapted those for use in the air. So instead of taking 15 minutes to half an hour, he brought those down to under 2 minutes, 40 seconds at night, 2 minutes during the day, using a variety of new equipment, procedures, and techniques. And so he actually tutored Lindbergh in celestial navigation in May of 1928. So almost exactly a year after Lindbergh flies to Paris, Lindbergh finally learns to navigate.
Wow.
And so this is kind of the tipping point. This is when and a lot of people start to follow in Lindbergh's footsteps. They say, okay, well, this guy's starting to get this figured out now. There's this PVH Weems guy. Let's go to him and learn how to do this. Now, this story was well known at the time. This business about Lindbergh getting tutored in navigation a year after flying to Paris was big news at the time. But Lindbergh's biographers have largely overlooked it, and whether that's because it interferes with the mythology, I don't know. But it's a story that we tell here in the gallery, and I think it's one that people are going to find very interesting. So everybody from Fred Noonan, Richard Byrd, the U.S. Army Air Corps owes a great deal to PVH Weems. So Harold Gaddy, who was Wiley Post Navigator in the Winnie Mae, which is our featured artifact here in the gallery, he was one of Weems' first students as well. So followed along with Gaddy, and actually Lindbergh, excuse me. But Gaddy was actually the tutor for Anne Morrow Lindbergh, so who often served as Lindy's co-pilot through the early 1930s. And amazingly enough, enough, Anne Morrow did her training when she was 8 months pregnant. So she flew a transcontinental flight as a navigator for Charles when she was 8 months pregnant. And she was an incredibly sharp navigator. One of the funny things that does come out in some of the records is that Gaddy remarked to PVH Weems after he trained Anne, he said, you know, I went out there to teach her, and she's about as sharp as anyone you're going to find. But Charles had already forgotten everything he knew. I had to totally reteach him everything. But what happens then is Lindbergh goes and convinces Pan Am to adopt these techniques. Gaddy then goes on to become the chief navigation engineer for the Air Corps and passes those techniques to the Air Corps. So when World War II begins, we have finally a viable system of global navigation that works. Now, of course, celestial navigation is not the whole story, and we tell the story about what's going on at Dead Reckoning and radio navigation as well. And
Since we're talking celestial navigation,
we're looking at kind of the ultimate evolution of celestial navigation now, and we're looking at a big white box. And this white box was popularly known by crews of the SR-71 Blackbird as R2-D2, and for obvious reasons, because he sits right behind the crew, right in front of the refueling port on the aircraft. And R2-D2 is a celestial navigator. It's hooked up with the inertial navigation system of the aircraft, but as long as it sees the stars, and it can see the stars rolling out of the hangar on the ground, or it can be at 85,000 feet over 2,200 miles an hour seeing the stars, but it does all those celestial navigation techniques that Weems had worked on, that the mariners in the 19th century had used, and it does them to accuracies of up to 100 feet. So not too far off of what we expect from systems like GPS today, using just the stars. So really a remarkable bit of technology, and when you think about it, there's only really 40 years separating the R2-D2 here from what Lindbergh was learning with PVH Weems there in 1928. So really a remarkable transformation took place in 40 years. So celestial navigation is not dead in aviation. There's certainly very few people that practice it in the aviation context, but of a lot of our advanced systems today, things like the B-2 bomber use celestial navigation as a backup in case GPS is jammed or is otherwise unavailable. These systems still do exist for our use today. One of the other kind of fun things that we show in the exhibit related to celestial navigation in the air is the Astrodome. And the Astrodome was a big deal for aircraft in World War II because it allowed the navigator to make celestial sightings but not be in the open air like they had been before, and also to keep the drag minimal on the aircraft. So it was a big feature, but one of the things that people don't realize is as soon as you start pressurizing the aircraft, whether it was B-29s or later aircraft, these were a real vulnerability, and they would occasionally pop off and create a rapid decompression. And so we actually feature a newspaper article about an episode on a TWA Constellation 1947 where actually a navigator was lost and a flight attendant was almost sucked out as well because the Astrodome failed. So that in itself pushed innovation, and what was brought in shortly after that was the periscopic sextant. So your Cold War bombers were flying, and transports were flying around with what we're looking at now, which was essentially a periscope that was also a sextant. So you'd be able to pop that up in a pressurized cabin and sight the stars with that. So that was the big innovation, celestial navigation in the 1950s.
And like all good tools, there's a stopwatch.
Absolutely.
So built right in.
It's the same standard World War II navigator's watch. Of course, these were surplused by the many tens of thousands after World War II, so they were readily available. And, you know, Vietnam, these were still being issued to flight crews regularly, so they were flying with the same watches they had in World War II. The other big thing that we're talking about here is the transition to radio navigation. And the big thing that happens in radio navigation is the quartz oscillator. And the quartz oscillator is a new way to measure time. When you have a mechanical clock, you can do about a half second accurately. With a quartz oscillator, you might be able to measure hundreds or even hundreds of thousands of a second accurately. currently. And so that allows you to measure how long it takes a high-frequency signal to return, like in radar. So navigational radar becomes possible after the quartz oscillators developed in the interwar years. Systems like LORAN become possible. And these are important, especially during World War II, because it takes so long to train these young guys, particularly in World War II, to be accurate in celestial navigation. And unfortunately, a lot of the guys that went overseas, the Army Air Forces trained over 50,000 navigators during World War II. A lot of those guys were sent over with very little experience under their belt. And they were being asked to do very complicated things with very minimal experience. And it led to errors. Episodes like the Lady Be Good kind of speak to that. And so there's a lot of push to create technological solutions. And so the black box, as we know it today, is very much part of that push during World War II to try and use technologies like the quartz oscillator to create new systems that are as accurate as the celestial navigation was, but do it much more effectively. Right now we're standing under the Winnie Mae, which is really representing this point at which the air navigator becomes a professional, a member of the flight crew that's capable of performing really those wonders of navigation that were expected either on the long-distance flights of the 1930s or during combat in World War II. And the Winnie Mae is really this turning point. So we mentioned Lindbergh in 1927 and the difficulties he faced because the technology wasn't up to speed. Well, in 1931, we're starting to see things turn around to a great degree. And in the navigator of the Winnie Mae in 1931 was Harold Gaddy, who was a Weems protege. And Gaddy was applying all those new techniques. So he had all those celestial techniques at his disposal and put them to use very effectively. And they shattered the around-the-world record, did it in 8 days here in the Winnie Mae, and really set a new standard for how things would be done. And, of course, that continues through the 1930s and even into the Cold War. We talk a little bit about Amelia Earhart and her disappearance, kind of put it in context. Fred Noonan was actually one of the Weems students, but unfortunately he really didn't have all the tools that he should have had available to him. I think if you look at the flight of Howard Hughes and his Lockheed 14 the next year, you can really see just an amazing difference in terms of the level of celestial navigation equipment that was carried on that flight versus what Earhart and Noonan were attempting to take on their flight in 1937. So we get to a little bit of the nitty-gritty of the disadvantages Earhart put herself to when she made that flight in 1937. A lot of people don't realize that the modern aviation hack watch comes out of the whole Weems and Lindbergh experience. In fact, Lindbergh actually marketed a version himself called the Lindbergh Hour Angle Watch, so we feature that here in the gallery. We talk a lot about the tools of navigation that any pilot in the U.S. is going to be familiar with. Things like the Mark II plotter that every private pilot gets, that's a Weems creation. We talk about the dead reckoning computers. So the E-6B was developed by Philip Dalton, but Philip Dalton was another Weems associate, so they partnered together to put those into production and get them out. Interestingly enough, the Navy, who was the military service that both Weems and Dalton belonged to, was not very supportive of their work. In the interwar years, there was a lot of kind of traditional perspective on innovation in the Navy. A lot of battleship officers and admirals that looked kind of down on these upstarts who were trying to figure out new ways of doing things and were perceived as kind of operating out of their place. And so while the Air Corps was very accepting of what Weems was doing, his own military service was not. So while all the American airlines and even some of the overseas services are adopting all these techniques, and the Air Corps is, the Navy is not. It's not really right until the very eve of World War II that the Navy kind of starts to run to catch up on a lot of these techniques finally.
Well, Roger, I appreciate you taking the time. It's a fantastic exhibit. And I look forward to spending some more time with you. And again, thank you for being on Airplane Geeks.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Wow, David, that was fascinating.
It's an amazing exhibit. My father was a star shooter in the Navy in World War II, so I got to learn a little bit more about things he used to talk about. And it is really kind of neat that it takes you from the beginning of time to the modern day.
So, David, tell us, as the historian and the expert now on navigation and time, Is it true that dead reckoning is called dead reckoning because if you got it wrong, you were dead?
I'll take your word for it because you've been around longer than I have.
Good
comeback.
I don't know. I mean, did you shot stars in the open cockpits when you were learning to fly?
Oh, my God. You know, Max, do I have to put up with this?
Yes.
Did seniority get you anything in this organization?
But he did talk about, what was it, the thing you used to navigate? I don't want to call it a slide rule, but there's the thing that PV...
An E6B computer. It's a sort of a circular slide rule, essentially, is what it is. And when I was in high school, I remember I had one of those big, I forgot the name of the company that used to make those big engineering slide rules. Max, I don't know if you remember them, but because you're almost old enough to have worked a slide. Did you ever work a slide rule, Max?
I just missed it. I had one, but I never really used it.
Well, anyway, but it was a way to do all the calculations. You could do time, distance, fuel, remaining. You could figure out wind correction angles and all on this little wheel that was probably maybe 5 inches in diameter. And I knew people that were really, really good with that. And, of course, now nobody knows how to run it because they just say, well, look, the GPS figures it all out. Why do I care?
Sure.
Except if it's wrong.
Yeah. David, thanks so much for that. Now, we have, as I mentioned before, David has a lot of additional recordings that he made, and we're going to have all those on the airplanegeeks.com website, along with some really extensive show notes that David put together about this exhibit and about navigation. And if you haven't been to airplanegeeks.com because you subscribe in iTunes or something similar, so you don't normally have much need to go to the site, this would be a good time to do that. And we'll lay out all the different recordings David made. And I think there's some benefit in going through them sort of chronologically, in the order that the tour took place, because it kind of takes you through a progression. Again, sea to air to space and to current day satellite navigation. So encourage folks to do that. So again, David, thanks so much.
Well, thank you. And of course, I'd like to thank the staff at the Smithsonian for giving us the opportunity. And I guess this would be a good time to announce that, yes, the three of us will be going back to be a pilot day. It was basically communicated to me from the Smithsonian staff that we are expected to be there.
Fantastic. And you know, hooray. And, you know, for folks who are going to become a pilot day, Father's Day weekend in June at the Udvar Hazy Center at Dulles, you know, maybe, David, people could make it a two-day trip and go down to the D.C. Smithsonian facility and see the navigation exhibit as well. That'd be a great sort of doubleheader kind of a weekend.
And I have to be honest with you, it's other than our trip out in January, it had been years since I actually have been to the downtown museum. And if you haven't been in a long time, because Udvar Hazy is sort of the new shiny museum, it's probably worth your while to take a visit and go back. And a lot has changed downtown. So I know that on the show, we talk a lot about Udvar Hazy because that's where Be a Pilot Day and stuff. But the Smithsonian in its entirety is an amazing museum, and keep in mind that half of this exhibit was from the American History Museum. And so there are other museums besides Air and Space that, well, we are lucky in the world to have the Smithsonian because it's probably the greatest collection of things in the world. So
absolutely.
And they built the Udvar Hazy Center just simply because there was no room for all the exhibits they wanted downtown, I think, wasn't it?
Well, yeah. Unfortunately, you can attest to this. Airplanes are big. The Smithsonian on the Mall was designed to hold exhibits, but it really never was intended to hold everything. The Smithsonian is the largest collection of aircraft in the world. And you don't put a 707 easily downtown in the Mall, let alone a Concorde and B-29s, etc. So the Air and Space Museum downtown is more exhibit-based. Each group has its own theme. There's a Naval History, a World War II exhibit, early flight. The Wright Flyer now has, and the Wright brothers have their own exhibit. They used to have the airplane hanging in the hall, in the main hall with the X-15 and the X-1. But each little thing, it has its own theme, whereas it's more of a giant hangar, as they call it, America's Hangar, out at Dulles. So both museums are well worth the time spent in them.
And now it's time for more David with the Aircraft of the Week. And David, are we finishing up the series this time?
We are finishing up the A4 Skyhawk. I guess I should thank everyone for their patience. This has been an interesting lesson for me. Sometimes you bite off more than you can chew. But so,
who's doing that?
Wait a minute. When did Fisher suddenly get on the show? We've never had sound effects.
I don't know, Steve.
All right. Well, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Airplane of the Week, the final fourth episode of the A4 Skyhawk. We've got three more variants to go through and one more, and away we go. Argentina was the first foreign country to purchase A4s. The Argentines wanted a replacement for their F-86s. In 1965, the Argentine government requested 50 surplus A4D1s, otherwise known as A4Bs. Douglas would upgrade these aircraft at their Tulsa, Oklahoma facility. The aircraft were zero-timed. The airframes were delivered as A4Ps, as in Peter. The deliveries took place in two batches, 25 in 1966 and 25 more in 1970. The A4B became known as the Casa, or Hunter, in Argentine. All FAA A4Ps would serve with the 5th Air Brigade. The Argentine Navy also would order 16 Bs, which would then be refurbished by Lockheed Air Services and become known as the A4Q. The A4Q would operate off the carrier the 25th of May, Argentine's only one. In 1975, again, the Argentines would reach out to purchase 25 more surplus A4Cs. These would eventually be retrofitted with spoilers in the 5 pylons of the F-wing that was standard at the time. On the 28th of March, 1982, the 25th of May launched its A4Qs to provide armed recon over the tiny islands of the Malvinas. They were in support of Task Force 20, the amphibious assault on the islands. By April 2nd, the islands were captured. On April 5th, Operation Corporate was begun by the Royal Navy, and they set sail to recapture the Falklands. Over the next 6 weeks of the conflict, the FAA and the Armada Skyhawk fleet would be decimated. 9 A4Cs with 8 pilots killed in action, 10 A4Ps with 9 pilots killed in action, 3 A4Qs with 1 pilot killed in action. The Skyhawks did inflict damage on the Royal Navy ships. The HMS Argonaut was damaged by A4Ps. The HMS Ardent sank by bombs from the Navy A4Qs. The HMS Antelope sunk by an A4P. The HMS Coventry sunk by A4Cs. And the RFA Sir Galahad sunk by A4Ps. The LCU HMS Fearless was also sunk by A4Ps. After the war, the United States placed an arms embargo on any new aircraft for Argentina. In 1988, the U.S. vetoed export of A4Hs from Israel to supply the country and replace the A4Qs. The fleet of A4s were all merged into the 5th Brigade. Under the Halcyon program, all Skyhawks were equipped with the 30mm DEFA cannons from Israel and given the F-wings with 5 hardpoints and split flaps. All A4C, P, and Q variants were retired from service in 1999. In 1994, the arms embargo was lifted by the United States, and Argentina ordered 32 surplus A4Ms. With the $282 million U.S. dollar deal came spares for the J-52 P-408 engines. The 20mm cannons were retained, and all the airframes were upgraded from Armark, or the Boneyard. The airframes were refurbished by Lockheed Martin. The Angle Rate Bomb System, or ARBS, was replaced with the APG-66 with HOTAS and 2 liquid crystal displays in the cockpit. The aircraft then became designated the A4AR Fighting Hawk, a name derived from its F-16 avionics and radar, fighting as in Fighting Falcon, and Hawk, needless to say, is obvious. With the purchase also came four TA-4Fs, or OA-4Ms, which were upgraded with the AR electronics, however, do not have the uprated P-408 engines. These four aircraft are called OA-4ARs. In 1972, the Royal Singapore Air Force purchased 40 surplus A-4Bs. Lockheed Air Services of Burbank did the upgrades. The A-4S received the F-wing with 5 hardpoints and split spoilers and nose gear steering. The engine included was the J-65W-20 with 8,400 pounds of thrust. This high-rater engine leads to the creation of the most interesting two-seaters as far as A-4s are concerned in the world. The TA-4S had a 20-inch longer cockpit section. However, instead of using a one-piece canopy, the Lockheed did what Lockheed always does and made a separate cockpit with its own bubble. It was a cost-saving measure because it caused the cockpit from a spare airframe and the two standard JU-52 two-seaters, the TA-4F, would have required maintenance of two different engines. Singapore would have a long history with the Skyhawk. Eventually, 70 more surplus Bs and Cs were purchased in 1980, the Cs becoming the A4S-1s, and the Bs were used for spare parts. Again, the TA-4S-1s would have the step cockpit with the double bubble. They also had 20mm Colt cannons instead of the DEFA cannons originally. In 1985, Singapore realized the A4 fuselages last forever. Engines do not. A modernization occurred by Singapore Aircraft Industries, and they installed the GE F404-100D non-afterburning turbojet, the kind found in F-117s and F-18s. The aircraft then became the A4SU with 29% more thrust. Its maximum speed at sea level was 700 miles per hour. It was this airframe that gave one of the most unique flight demonstrations of all time, the 1999-2000 Singapore Black Knights. The Black Knights flew a diamond of A4SUs, and the solos were F-16As, making for a unique Delta formation, or the Thunderbirds and the Blue Angels coming together to form one team, before sequester. But last but not least, the TDUM, or the Royal Malaysian Air Force, ordered 88 surplus A4Cs and A4Ls, 25 and 63 respectively. The intention was to create 54 single-seat and 14 dual-seat trainers. Grumman Aerospace zero-timed the airframes. Refurbished aircraft with F-wings and any A4C was giving the hump of the L. Lastly, the ability to fire both the Maverick and Sidewinders were added. The new aircraft first flew on April 12, 1984. The aircraft were given the designation A4PTM and eventually known as A4s Peculiar to Malaysia. Six A4Ls were given 28-inch plugs. The additional cockpit was given the standard glass of the two-seaters, making the TA-4PTM an awkward-looking machine with a large canopy and the small nose of the sea. The TUDM would fly the scooters until 1994, keeping six flying with the D-704 refueling pod in action for another 5 years. In 1999, they were all replaced with British Aerospace Hawk 298s. The Skyhawk will soldier on as a warbird and as a frontline aircraft for years. They've been part of my life for a very long time, and I'm proud to look at that six-foot piece of steel that represents the greatest attack aircraft of all time in my workroom, the A4 Skyhawk. So next week, we'll return to a normal history segment. Thanks for putting up with my long-winded exposition on Heidemann's Hot Rod. This has been David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
Wow. Massive, David. That's really fantastic. Let's see. We had, what, four parts total?
4 parts total.
Yeah, boy, you put all those together, and that's quite a body of work. Nicely done. Thank you, David.
And hence the story of the tailhook scandal began.
There is a very famous patch that I own in my patch collection that has a picture that says tailhook and the year, and it's Bart Simpson, and he's looking, holding a tailhook, and he says, "I didn't do it. You can't prove it. Nobody saw me."
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 21st of April, 2013. I'm back!
You are back, and welcome, folks, to the Australia Desk for episode 245. Grant, where were you last week? You know, Jonesy stepped in and he opined that you might have had man flu.
Yeah, no, it was more just a vicious headache and unable to concentrate on anything, so I had to have an early night. Not quite migraine status, but definitely not up to my usual witty repartee of the Oz Desk, shall we say?
Well, don't worry, I thought Jonesy did a good job. You know, in fact, if we could just draft him every week and we found one other person, you and I could take every Sunday night off.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought, actually. That could be kind of fun, man. I mean, you know, taking some time off and working on everything else we've got to do. Yeah, okay.
Anyway, let's get on with this week's news. Well, it's all Qantas this week, and they've been showing off their new crew uniforms. Now, Grant, everybody who knows me knows that I am a fashion heathen, but I've got to say, these new Qantas uniforms, apart from the men's ties, I'm not too big on those, but the rest, well, they look pretty snazzy. What do you think?
Yeah, not too bad. I wasn't that sure about the hats, but apparently the staff wanted them. But, you know, I do have an ace up my sleeve here, and I recruited someone to give me a hand and watched the catwalk videos and looked at the photos with my lovely lady, Kit, who is, of course, into fashion and did fashion design as one of her courses. So, yeah, we had a chat, and as she said, it was quite nice. Didn't look too bad, reasonably stylish. I immediately noted that the Trekkies in the universe would be quite interested in them because they are rather next-gen looking at times, especially the shirt that Miranda Kerr was wearing. But while they are quite up with the modern times and looking pretty good, and nice use of the red angular slash and triangle of the Qantas brand on the tails, so to speak, as Kit said, you wouldn't want to be perhaps a little dumpy and wearing one, or she's not sure just quite how flattering that'd be on someone of, shall we say, normal body style. Not everyone is as classically built as the folks were on the runway. They were all Qantas staff, including Miranda Kerr, who is one of the ambassadors. But yeah, look, they did have quite a few to choose from to select the ones that had reasonably trim bodies, shall we say.
Now, these new uniforms were designed by Paris-based Australian fashion designer Martin Grant. And I say that like I know who he is, but as I said, I know nothing about it. But here's what he had to say about the design of the new uniforms on radio this week.
As the inspiration, I've taken the iconic Qantas logo, which is the red triangle. So I've taken quite classical dark navy suitings, for example, and put a red triangle on the lapel.
Grant, have you got any idea what he's talking about?
Sadly, I kind of do, but that's mostly in the same way that Kit has learned about aviation through osmosis and just happening to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. So too, I've learned a little bit about what these guys are talking about, which is really scary.
And so I've taken the red, the Qantas red, which is a quite orange.
Well, good on you, Martin. I've got no idea what you're talking about there, mate, but he has done a good job, and they do. You know, the men's ties, I don't know about those, but the rest of it, very, very interesting. And, you know, it came out that Martin Grant went to Nunawading High here in Melbourne, and that's significant to me because my mother went to Nunawading High, and she's not a fashion designer. So good on Qantas. I guess it was time for an upgrade, and I reckon that looks pretty good. And interestingly, too, Grant, I noticed the Jetstar uniforms were included in the fashion walk there. The only thing that I found weird was the undersoles of their shoes are red.
Yeah.
Like something out of The Wizard of Oz, maybe.
I must admit, I hadn't actually quite looked at that area. I guess I was distracted by the red triangular sashes and so on the jackets. But anyhow.
You were too busy being distracted by Miranda Kerr, just be honest.
Yeah, these ones are quite different compared to the old, and it'll be interesting to see how they look on people in reality.
Yes, absolutely. Well, let's move on to matters military. Now we've talked in the past about the Royal Australian Navy's attempts to purchase some new helicopters. And in fact, they were looking at the Super Sea Sprites, and we reported probably a couple of years back now that program had ended up being shelved. The Royal Australian Navy had had a different idea about how to operate those with a crew of two, I think, instead of a traditional crew of three. Couldn't make it work, and it was quite controversial, cost a fortune, and those aircraft were shelved, and we didn't really hear much more about it, but the New Zealand government has found them, and they've decided to buy 8 of them at a cost of $200 million Australian, Grant, which is about 240 million Kiwi dollars.
That's right, mate, and I guess the Kiwis have got a little bit of cash now that Draken have purchased the Markies and the A4s from storage, but the Kiwis are already running Sea Sprites. They're running them the same way as everyone else around the world does, crew of three, and they're not trying to make them two crew operations as the Australians were, which caused all sorts of problems as they tried to squeeze all the software and controls and everything into one panel for two crew rather than having the, I believe it was the taco down the back and so on. So the Kiwis have taken the old RAN ones and they're going to make sure they're standard operational and bring them back into line and, yeah, make use of them, which I think is great because they were sitting there not going anywhere for a while, which was a shame.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, of course, this program at the time it was audited, not long before it was canned, had run up bills of $1.4 billion Australian dollars. So a very expensive program considering that it never came to fruition here. And of course, the Royal Australian Navy has gone with the SH-60, the Seahawk, which makes much more sense in my opinion because, well, we've already got a fleet of those and we've got lots of Blackhawks here as well. So to me, that makes sense. But there you go. What would I know? Now, there were so many failures with this system when they were trying to make it work that, you know, obviously that's been brought up in the press over there. But the New Zealand Defence Minister, Jonathan Coleman, has been quoted as saying that he is acutely aware of the Australians' problems with the Sea Sprites, but he's not concerned about it too much at all. As you say, Grant, they're already operating the type over there, and I'm sure the Kiwis will benefit greatly from having eight more of them in their hands.
Indeed, indeed. This is like the A4 Skyhawk all over again, mate. The Aussies sell them to the Kiwis, and then I wonder if they'll wind up leasing them operationally back.
Well, you never know. Well, let's just make sure that Helen Clark just doesn't become Defence Minister.
No, not much chance of that, mate.
Now, getting back on our side of the Tasman, Grant, Bush airstrips call for $20 million, says this article here in The Australian by aviation writer Steve Creedy, one of our favourites. What's going on there?
Well, based on the success of the Regional Aerodrome Development Fund that Western Australia set up to help keep aerodromes operational out in the boonies of that enormous state that Ben Jones comes from, as you guys were discussing last week, the Australian Airports Association says that because half of their regional airports are running at an annual loss, council owners struggling to find the money to upgrade facilities, all the other issues that are coming up at the moment, they're saying the federal government should put into a central fund for maintaining and upgrading the, as they say, bush airstrips.
Now, it's interesting here, Grant, that we've got yet another aviation lobby group wading into the political situation here as the election looms. And when I say looms, it's still 5 or 6 months away. Good Lord.
Mate, but it's looming. It's looming. It's just distant.
Did I mention a couple of weeks ago it's going to be a very long year politically? But good on them. I would say that $20 million on the surface of it wouldn't seem like that much to ask for. Now, WA politically is not going to get a lot of money because on current polling, the government's not going to win any seats over there by the looks of it. So they're not bothering to put a lot of money over there, but good luck to them. And the other problem is if the other side gets in, well, they already think they're a shoo-in, so they don't think they need to spend any money. So I don't know how they're going to go getting it. And WA is probably the richest state in Australia at the moment. It's where all the wealth is being generated. So, you know, really, I think they should be getting some money to improve their infrastructure and make sure those airports stay open. One of the things that, you know, governments should look at is the economic benefits to any community, particularly remote communities out in, you know, regional Australia where, you know, you're hundreds and even thousands of kilometres from anywhere else, you've got to have a look at the economic benefit to any town of having an airport there. And, okay, on the surface of it, the airport itself might lose a bit of money, but how much money does it help to bring into a community? That's what they should be looking at, in my opinion.
Totally. You've got to look at the bigger picture and also the essential services aspect when you get floods, when you get natural disasters or other emergencies, and half the time the roads are either too long or cut off. The only access is via the air, and that's suddenly where an airport is very essential to have. And as they're saying, it's working in WA. Let's make it work around the country. They're also saying that the local councils and airport owners will be putting in money anyhow. And the idea here is that the federal government puts a dollar per dollar equal amount up to match whatever the local council or owners are able to put up.
Actually, good to see some people lobbying for aviation this time around. We haven't seen this quite so actively, I think, in previous elections, certainly not in the time that we've been doing this sort of coverage, Grant. So hopefully, you know, the industry will find a louder voice. It's certainly well needed. I notice here too, Grant, that they were actually calling on the government to take note of technology changes and quieter aircraft, having those taken into consideration when considering the movement caps at Sydney. Good luck with that, guys. That might be a little bit too ambitious. Just stick with the $20 million. I think they'll have far more chance of getting that. Well, that's about everything we have for you this week. There you go, Grant. Three quick stories and some pretty upbeat positive news this week. Good to hear.
Yay! I'm always up for some positive news in aviation. I'm even more happy to report on positive news related to my aviation, but we may have to wait a little while for that.
You come over here and help me study for my positive aviation at the moment, Grant. I'm plowing through study manuals at the moment. Did you know they have these things called GPS?
Oh, dude! Next you'll be telling me you've got a radio you can put in the aircraft.
All right, yeah, absolutely. You don't even have to pedal to use it. I tell you what, it's just not like the good old days, mate.
No, back when you were hanging with Smithy.
Well, heading back to look at the study manuals until next week. I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran.
Cheers, folks.
So my only question is, if Kit is so into fashion, what's she doing with Grant?
Well, I think I have a question that kind of lines up with that. It's related to the Australianese that none of us seem to speak. What the heck is the man flu?
I know. Yeah, I sort of slipped that in there. I noticed that, too. The man flu. I have to get out my Australian dictionary again and look that one up.
So what if she's a fashion maven and the guy has the man flu? I think we ought to get her on the show to find out what the hook is with.
No, with, that's an
Grant,
idea.
Don't you think?
Absolutely.
I mean,
yeah.
It's the rose colored glasses he looks through.
Yeah, you're right.
All right. Thanks, Steve, and thanks, Grant. And now we have Peter Johnson across the pond.
Today, we welcome back Frances Peters from Aviation Platform to talk European aviation and of particular interest, the Benelux countries. Frances, welcome back across the pond.
Thank you, Peter, for having me on today.
Thanks for joining us again. Frances, let's start by looking at what's going on between KLM, Air France and Alitalia.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because if you look at the history that KLM has with Alitalia, it goes way back, because they have a joint venture. They started code sharing before even Air France and KLM were working together. From a couple of months ago, Air France KLM decided to support Alitalia because, well, they needed a capital injection
to
survive. And if you look at the, well, for instance, the economic situation in Italy, it's not going that good.
So
Alitalia is struggling on the Italian market, but also on the long-haul market. And Air France, I think they have a 25% stake in Alitalia. So it benefits them to support Alitalia because a significant part of their, Mediterranean traffic on long haul is provided by Alitalia.
And do you think there's any chance that in the future that the KLM and Air France group would actually purchase Alitalia?
Yeah, that's going around since January of this year. KLM is denying this, Air France also. They have had some talks about, after the 38 million they injected in Alitalia this year, there are some talks about it, but they're still denying this as a takeover or a large-scale merger with two parties.
Yeah. I mean, who would have thought 10 or even 20 years ago that three of Europe's biggest airlines would have been working so closely?
I think no one.
you couldn't imagine it. One other thing we wouldn't have seen 10 or 20 years ago was baggage fees, and I think KLM are thinking about introducing them.
Yeah, that's they're the first ones as full-service carriers to introduce this. From April, so this month, they're introducing baggage fees for hold baggage.
Right.
So your carry-on baggage is still free, but the hold baggage, they're charging passengers about 15 euros
Really?
Pay in advance, so you buy a ticket and also include the hold baggage.
Yeah.
And, at the check-in, you buy 30 euros, so it's significant.
And there's been some resistance, I think, maybe a good way of describing it, to this whole program. There's been a lot of traffic on Twitter, and I think Facebook also has a Facebook page with a petition against it. What's the feeling in Holland about this?
Well, if you look around and the frequent flyers, they really don't mind because KLM says the ticket price is going down. We take the baggage fee we take off. So if you fly without bags, well, you save 15 euros. Not exactly, but you save on that.
Yeah.
And when you fly with bags, well, you pay for it. It's just like the local carriers.
Okay, Not great, but I think inevitable. And still within the group, Air France is moving to bring in a new regional low-cost carrier called HOP. I think that's now been implemented.
Yes, it's indeed introduced in the beginning of this year, HOP. It's a, well, low-cost carrier. And it's a combination of some smaller Air France subsidiaries.
Yeah.
It put together and is primarily for the well, the European traffic, because if you know the Air France KLM group, the European market is struggling to survive.
Yeah,
they're losing money on that part, so they had to make some other plans to compete with, well, for instance, Ryanair and EasyJet, Norwegian.
Yeah,
if you look at those carriers, they're buying a lot of new aircraft.
Yeah. But,
well, the big guys don't have that option to buy, well, say 100 737s or something. So you have to do some other operations, not the same with full service, but also within the Air France group, well, to also increase their revenues from that part.
Yeah. And Frances, is that just going to be through Air France's network, or will they service KLM network and potentially Alitalia's? Is it just France?
Yeah, it's primarily from France. Some traffic would be taken over from, say, KLM, Alitalia, but that are not that many routes.
Right, okay.
Adding to the traffic already from France and adding some additional routes that the subsidiaries already had.
Yeah, okay. And continuing the developments, just going back to Holland, one of the challenges in Europe has been the pressure on some of the big hubs like London, Amsterdam, Frankfurt for international and long-haul traffic. Schiphol seems to be doing really well at the moment.
Yeah, it's still growing. About 1 million passengers a year or something. So that's relatively going well. And if you look at the operations, yeah, of course, KLM has a big part in the growth.
Yeah.
So on long haul, they're doing relatively good. It's only the short-haul operations of KLM within Europe, not that good. But on the other hand, they have a new H-Pier for, well, low-cost airlines. So EasyJet is also increasing the passenger amount at Schiphol, so it's been like a synergy between low-cost carriers on one side and KLM long haul on the other side.
Yeah, and there's been some additional investment from the Schiphol group coming in, and they're upgrading some of the parts of the airport. Do you think Schiphol could become a real challenger to Heathrow as the major European hub?
If Heathrow doesn't change anything, yes. Hopefully not in the near future, but Schiphol has the advantage above Heathrow and even Paris, the Charles de Gaulle, because if you look at, for instance, the minimum connecting time, that's at Schiphol is about 45 to 50 minutes. And when you compare that with, well, say, the other major hubs, they're at least 15 to 20 minutes longer.
Yeah.
But for transfer passengers, that's really a good option to, well, fly via Amsterdam and then further on to well, another destination.
Well, Frances, thank you very much for joining us again today. Where can we find out about you online?
Yeah, you can find us on LinkedIn. We have a LinkedIn group, a Facebook page. We have a Twitter account. And, of course, our website, aviationplatform.com.
Thank you very much for joining us again.
Well, thank you, Peter, and hope to hear you next time.
Thank you. This is Peter Johnson reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
And thanks, Peter. Boy, Frances is great. I like listening to him. He knows a lot of good stuff.
Yeah, he doesn't sound like he's from England like Peter is, though, I guess, right?
No. He's with, let's see, where is Frances from? I'm not sure.
Actually, I think he said he was from Holland, wasn't he?
Yeah. Yes, I think so.
Yeah, I know. I'm just pulling your leg.
He's just becoming the third Dutchman in the collection. Visscher, Vanderhoof, and we have a lot of them.
This is kind of scary. I'm not sure what that means. Okay, because we're running a little bit long, I think what we'll do is defer our listener story until next time and move right into the listener mail. And our first mail actually comes from Peter, and it's about last week's listener story. Peter wrote to us. Now, this is really interesting. Peter wrote to us, I knew I recognized the tiger moth. The tiger moth story was our listener story from last week. And Peter says, that's my home airfield and one I regularly visit with my two-year-old daughter, Beatrice. We always watch the tiger moth fire up and often photograph her as well. There are a few on my Facebook page. Small world, huh? So I think that's pretty wild, huh? And Peter closes, he throws in his vote for AOPA president. We had a listener last week toss Aunt Benet into the ring and got his vote. Peter writes, my vote for AOPA president is, I'd play a drum roll if I had one, Dave the Hand Puppet from last week. So thanks, Peter. That's pretty clever.
I'm sorry, he mispronounced his last name. It's Dave the Sock Puppet.
That's right. Peter said the hand puppet. Well, you know, maybe Dave the Hand Puppet is Dave the Sock Puppet's twin brother.
Oh, you know, that could be. That could be. And of course,
they usually come in pairs. They usually come in pairs.
Oh, God.
It sounds obvious when you say it. That's brilliant. Okay, we heard from Ken. Ken is a CRJ 200 first officer from Atlanta. Ken said, and this is before he heard last week's episode, he says, I see you guys have Captain Jeff as a guest this week. I can't wait. My two favorite podcasts come together as one. We actually got a lot of positive response from folks about our conversation with Captain Jeff Nielsen from AirlinePilotGuy.com.
You mean the guy that sounds like the airline captain?
He does. He has that captain's voice.
Fine. Yeah. So we had sort of a midair collision, I guess, between the airplane geeks and Captain Jeff. I mean, but it all worked out.
It was fantastic. Well, Ken also says a super big thanks for turning me on to the Aviators TV back in episode 242. I heard of the show, but never knew where to find it. And now I'm just about done with season one, watching on my Amazon Prime account. Maybe someday it will be more than one show. I look forward to the day when I can find the Aviation Network on my channel lineup with 24/7 programming of aviation news, shows, and movies. What a dream come true that would be. So thanks, Ken. Yeah, that I think there are some people out there thinking along those lines. So we may see something like that. We heard from Andy. Here we go. Andy says, hey, Max, I was just listening to episode 243 when you went through the listener mail. I thought I'd let you know that Morgan is pronounced Morgan and Nuque is pronounced Nuki. He says us Brits have these strange spellings so we can easily recognize foreigners. And in this case, it worked because I couldn't pronounce those properly if my life depended on it. So thanks to Andy for straightening the record out.
Yeah, it's like the actor Liam Neeson. When I first saw his name, I thought, who would name their kid Liam? But you're right. That's how they know we're not one of them.
Yeah. So Ray sent in an email. He says, thanks for yet another fascinating and envy-inducing podcast, referring to number 244 last week. He said it was pretty interesting hearing Captain Jeff's story about the captain he had flown with who had a real short fuse and would, I think, in Captain Jeff's words, screw himself into the ceiling in a temper. He says, fortunately, that guy apparently calmed down really quickly. But Ken says, back in June of 72, the captain of a BEA Trident got into a very heated argument with a junior pilot over a planned pilot strike. The outburst was vocally very violent. The episode was short-lived. The captain calmed down somewhat and apologized for his flare-up, but those who had witnessed it agreed that the upcoming strike, which this captain opposed as unbecoming of airline captains, and he was campaigning hard amongst senior pilots to support his views, was a source of quite some tension to him. So subsequently, the Trident taxied out and took off from Heathrow for a flight to Brussels. In the cockpit were this captain and two other, or in the cockpit were this captain and two rather junior co-pilots. About 2 minutes after the takeoff, a kid cycling along the road saw the Trident come out of the low clouds in a flat but nose-up attitude, but with little forward speed, and crashed into a field. Everyone aboard was killed. He says the FDR showed various departures from BEA's standard procedures in the way the takeoff had been made, the different phases of the climb out having been entered at inappropriate speeds. The error that started the unraveling of the flight was the retraction of the leading edge droop at a speed at least 15 knots too slow. Even then, the die was not cast. The stick pusher shoved the nose down, and had either pilot reapplied takeoff power to the engines at the time they were in noise abatement power, the recovery could have been made. Or had they deployed the leading edge droop, the aircraft would have been flyable. Instead, the autopilot was disconnected and the nose raised. No additional power was applied, no deployment of the droop was made, and thus the plane entered a deep stall. Says this was in the days before CVRs, but they had the FDR and pathology reports. The medical evidence showed that the captain had a heart condition in which a rapid rise in blood pressure could cause a tear. If this had happened at the time of the pre-flight argument, he would have had symptoms of very severe indigestion. This discomfort could account for the terseness in his voice noted in the transmissions to the tower after takeoff. Also, this terseness, combined with the captain's reputation for temper, could have influenced the junior co-pilots to not offer opinions on the actions taken at incorrect speeds. It was considered most likely that the captain had been the one to retract the droop prematurely. Whether his health was distracting him sufficiently to do the wrong thing, or whether in a confused state he thought he was retracting the flaps to gain speed, they were in fact already retracted, and by mistake retracted the droop, is not known. There is a possibility, too, that around this time he could have become incapacitated and the other people in the cockpit were sufficiently distracted so as not to recognize the true cause of the stall warning and stick push. Believing that the stall warning was not working correctly, they disabled it. At that stage, the crash was inevitable. So that's about an accident that very well could have resulted from getting too angry. And then has having this sort of cascading set of consequences.
Well, I think an interesting story that I want to send over to you tonight that we can post in the notes actually came out today about a similar concept. David Learmonth, who's a senior writer over at Flight Global in London, wrote a story about the number of airline crashes. I think he said just in the last 10 years that have involved situations in which something occurred to the flying pilot, which I believe in this case we thought was the captain, and how the non-flying pilot, in this case the first officers, just did nothing. That they could have made the airplanes fly if they had had the wherewithal to grab the reins and fly the airplane, but they did not. And he lists, 12 or 15 accidents in which this wow. this was the issue. So, whether it's pilot incapacitation or the flying pilot doing something stupid or whatever, I mean, that's what the co-pilot's supposed to be there for, to say, hey, wait a minute, that's not a good idea. And unfortunately, that still doesn't happen enough.
All right, just to finish up, one last note. Let's say last week we talked about the security expert who gave a presentation about hacking an airplane with an Android. Also, if you listen to Captain Jeff's recent episode of Airline Pilot Guy, he actually went into some more detail than we did about that topic. But we also heard from Tom Bruchhaver, who has a post in his blog that's worth taking a look at. It's called Flying and Technology Blog. The website is Flying and Technology, android.blogspot.com, and his post is Hacking with Android, and it's an interesting piece. It's an interesting blog. I guess it's new. There's just three posts, at least at the time I looked at it, but we'll offer that up and give Tom a plug. It's a great, it looks like it's off to a great start, so take a look at the Flying and Technology blog. All right, I think that's about it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. Again, David, thanks so much for the recordings from the Air and Space Museum. And again, we'll have those that you heard, plus many more that David recorded at airplanegeeks.com, so you can go there and listen to those. We want to thank our contributors, as always, Grant McCarron and Steve Fisher from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast, and also Peter Johnson, who is producing the Aviation Extended podcast. All right, let's tell folks where they can find each of us online. So we'll start with David Vanderhoof. David, where do folks find you?
You can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com, and the 10,000-word essay, otherwise known as the History of the Avor Skyhawk, probably will be up there in the next couple of days after this show comes out. Or you can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof, and you can always find me lurking around the airports of Whitman and Addison.
All right. And Rob Mark, where do people find you?
Well, first of all, let's get to the really important things. I want to know what man flu is. Just
okay.
Just, and Stephen Grant, just in case you weren't sure, that's directed at you guys. Okay, jetwine.com, Jetwine on Twitter. Go read a cool story about how lousy our politicians are when it comes to dealing with the aviation industry, if you're so inclined. Where else can they find me? In the basement, still ripping out more things that got destroyed by the Great Chicago Flood of 2013, but and I don't know, and I'll probably be out there at what are we doing out there at Smithsonian? They're going to make us museum pieces, or we're going to visit the museum in June?
I hope to visit the museum in June.
Oh, okay. All right, just check.
I would take being made into a museum piece.
Yeah, remember what happened to Han Solo in the second Star Wars, where they encased
him in carbonite? Yeah.
That didn't go over too well.
And I'm Max Flight. Look for me on Google Plus and Twitter as Max Flight. You can also check out my aviation directory at 30,000feet.com. You can find show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com. This is episode 245. We'll have links to all the sites that we mentioned. As I said several times, links to the additional recordings from David. Also, be sure to follow Airplane Geeks on Twitter and Facebook and Google+. And we're on Stitcher.com as well. You can stream us right to your mobile phone or other mobile device through Stitcher. If you'd like to send us an email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. Aunt Benet's got that number.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for
episode
listening.
Episode 241, huh?
No, wow. 45.
So we're on episode 245.
Yeah.
Huh?
Boy.
We're five episodes away from a sesquicentennial. Wow.
We have to start planning for episode 1,000. Oh, good night, guys.
Oh, my God.
Good night, everybody.
Bye. Bye.
Sweet Caroline, bum, 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 good times never seem so good. I've been inclined, bum, bum, bum.
Okay, ready for some Australians?
Yep.
No. Oh, I mean, yeah.
Working on everything else we've got to do. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, we could work on our own show. There's a novel thought. Anyway, anyway, let's get on with this week's news. Now, it's interesting that Grant, here we have yet another aviation organization wading into the political now, it's interesting, Grant, here we have another, what am I trying to say here?